Welcome to the Michael Slate Show. I'm your host, Michael Slate. Today's show is going to be really, really interesting. Of course, I say that every week, and every week it is, and I'm hoping it gets more interesting each week as we go along. Towards the back end of the show, we'll be talking with Keith Knight, cartoonist, creator of Think, a syndicated socio-political comic strip, also the Nightlife and the K Chronicles, and he's also the 2010 Glyph Award and Inkpot Award winner. His newest work is Too Small to Fail, another Think anthology. Keith Knight will be joining us in studio towards the back end of the show. But first, I was really, really fortunate to get a chance to talk with Ethan McCord. Ethan McCord is a truth teller and war resister. In 2007, Ethan found himself in the middle of the ground war in Baghdad. He was an army specialist over there, and he walked into the scene, into a scene that was being filmed from an Apache helicopter from which 12 Iraqi civilians had been shot to death. This attack's been seen by millions of people. It was the first WikiLeaks video to be released. It's now known as the collateral murder video, and it was released a year ago. Since then, Ethan has been speaking out against U.S. wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, and his story of coming to grips with the Army's rules and the loss of civilian life and all the horror he was in the midst of and forced to take part in during those wars brought him to say the thing I couldn't live without in Iraq was my own humanity. And so we're going to take a listen right away. We're just going to go right into this. This is a conversation I had with Ethan McCord just a little while ago, yesterday. I am really pleased and honored to welcome to the show my guest. He's Ethan McCord, and as you heard earlier, he is the soldier you could see in the first WikiLeaks video, the collateral murder video. He's the soldier you could see carrying a child's body. And since then, he's become the soldier you could see standing up and talking about what the hell was wrong with that, what was going on. Ethan, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Just for people who may not be all that familiar or may have forgotten, tell people what happened that day.
Basically, we were tasked out to do a cordon and a search that day. It was a volatile neighborhood. We had been having a lot of problems there with IEDs and small arms attacks. So we left the FOB about 4 o'clock in the morning.
The FOB is?
Forward Operating Base. And we went out to do a cordon search, which is we park the vehicles in an area, we knock on the doors of homes and ask to search for militia-related materials, anything that has to do with bomb-making materials, weapons that you're not supposed to have and whatnot. And so we were doing that for the majority of the morning, and nothing was really going on. We heard that other platoons were taking some RPGs and AK-47 attacks, and so we were told we were going to close up shop and leave. And so as we were funneling into a alleyway, a couple of men on rooftops jumped up and fired their AK-47s at us. So we took cover and we were returning fire when we could hear the Apaches firing their 30-millimeter rounds, cannons. And we didn't know what was going on at the time. We didn't get any of the radio chatter or whatnot. So we were told to move to that location. I was approximately 5 blocks away, and we started running towards that location. I was one of about 12 soldiers who were on foot. I ran to the corner and came up onto the scene, and coming up on the scene, I was one of the first 6 soldiers to get onto the scene, and what I saw was a group of men by a wall who had just been completely obliterated, destroyed by this 30-millimeter rounds. I then saw a minivan off in the distance that had been shot up as well, and I saw an RPG and an AK-47 laying on the ground as well as a camera. I thought in my mind, you know, well, these guys with the AK-47 and RPG are obviously insurgents who attacked this van, because I could hear children crying in the van. So I ran up to the van and looked inside the passenger door, and what I saw was a little girl about 4 years old with a severe belly wound. She had glass all over her in her hair and in her eyes. Next to her, half laying on the floorboard with his head resting on the bench seat, was a boy about 7 years old who I presumed was dead because of the severe wound to the right side of his head. And then next to him in the driver's seat was who I immediately concluded was the father. The way he was hunched over the children in kind of a protective manner, as a parent would do over his children. So my first thought was to grab the little girl. I yelled for a medic, and we went into the house behind the van and started cleaning her off and dressing her wounds. And I took my gloves off and was picking glass out of her eyes as much as I could so that she can blink. That's when you can hear in the video, there's nothing else I can do here. She needs to be evac'd, and that's the medic. I then hand the little girl to the medic, and he runs her to the Bradley. I go back outside, and I go back up to the van, and I look inside the van to take pictures. And in doing so, I saw the boy take like a labored breath movement, like he was trying to breathe. And that's when I started screaming out that the boy's alive, the boy's alive. And I picked him up and cradled him in my arms and kept telling him, don't die, don't die, I have you, don't die, and started running towards the Bradley. Now, in the video, you can see where I kind of slow down before I get to the Bradley. And at this point is when he opened his eyes and looked up at me, and then his eyes rolled back into his head. And at that point, I thought that the little boy had died in my arms, so I slowed down. You know, and when I saw these kids, the only thing I was thinking of was my own children back at home. I had a little girl who was the same age as this little girl. And my son was born just 1 month prior to this incident happening. So I lay the boy into the Bradley, and my platoon leader is standing there, and he starts yelling at me, McCord, what the F are you doing? Quit trying to save these effing kids and go pull security. You know, at the time, the only thing you can do really is say roger that, and you go up and you pull security. But yeah, so later that night, I started kind of piecing it together as I was cleaning the blood of the children off of my uniform, off my IBA, as to what happened. And, you know, a flood of emotions was coming over me. You know, I couldn't believe that this United States that I loved so much and that I swore to serve would kill innocent people. And especially innocent children. So I went to my staff sergeant in my line and asked to see mental health because I wasn't able to deal properly in the Army sense with the incidents that happened. And he told me I needed to suck it up and quit being a pussy and to get the sand out of my vagina. And that if I was to go to mental health, I could be charged with malingering, which is a crime. So again, the only thing you can really do is say roger that and suck it up and drive on. That was just one incident of many, many, many incidents that happened.
Let me remind listeners that you're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Ethan McCord. Ethan's the soldier who can be seen in the collateral murder video rescuing children from what really is a scene of mass carnage and doing it in spite of a lot of pulls not to do it. Basically, the kind of pressure that comes down on somebody who wants to do right in a terrible situation. Ethan, tell me this. You said that, and I was really intrigued by something I read earlier that you had said. You said that when people see this video, that they're only seeing a piece of what war is really about, especially with the war that the U.S. is waging in Iraq. Sure. Can you explain that?
Yeah, I mean, this is just one incident out of many incidents that I witnessed over there. This happens on a daily basis in Iraq. So when this video came out, I was actually quite shocked as to the reaction it received. I guess thinking that everybody knew that this kind of happened, you know, that this is what war is. And everybody's like, oh, these damn soldiers shooting all these people and stuff. And I started getting upset because people are blaming the soldiers. What you have to understand is these aren't a few bad apples strained from the system. This is the system in place. This is how U.S.-led wars are waged in the region. This is how soldiers are trained to react and act. And just like the U.S. military is going to go ahead and say that the Afghanistan kill team is a few bad apples strained from the system. Well, we have a lot of bad apples strained from the system then. Otherwise, this really is the system.
You know, it's one thing for people to hear that, and I want to get into that a little bit more in the next few minutes, but you say that what people saw in this video, this attack, this carnage that was there, mm-hmm. happened on a daily basis and probably sometimes even on an hourly basis in different circumstances. What kind of things? I know, for instance, I saw your blog and you had put up pictures of the abuse that prisoners, detainees were given, and then other things that had happened there that really kind of shocked me as I was reading it. And I'm not somebody who's unfamiliar with the ravages of war, so right. it was very heavy to see this.
Well, yeah, I mean, we were given orders for 360-degree rotational fire whenever anybody in our line in our convoy was hit by an IED, an improvised explosive device.
What does that mean?
Well, basically, every time that we were hit by a roadside bomb, we were told to kill every MF-er on the street. Men, women, and children. I watched this carried out. I watched people get shot, innocent people getting shot because we were given orders to kill. We were given orders to fire indiscriminately. Soldiers would get angry and kill people because they were angry. And I watched a Bradley that got hit by an IED attack a van that was full of children. And we had to stay there in the vehicles and watch as the Iraqi police were pulling these bodies of children out of this minivan, just destroyed bodies out of a minivan. And the Iraqi police, I remember the look like it was yesterday. They're standing there looking at us, just shaking their heads in disgust. And, you know, stuff like that happened on a constant basis because, you know, nobody cares about the Iraqis except for the Iraqis. Americans don't care. At least that's the general consensus in Iraq. We've been trained since day one to dehumanize these people. And there's a lot of things that I learned to live without in Iraq. I learned to live without a shower, without good food. But the one thing I refused to live without was my own humanity when I went there.
That's an extremely important point. You know, one of the things that I was going to ask you about, because I had this woman named Kathleen Barry on the show a little while back, and she wrote a book called Unmaking War, Remaking Men. And in it, one of the most interesting things I found in it was the fact that she talked about how kids like yourself, you know, at a certain point, not that you're a kid now, way back when, young men would be taken, and in a sense, trained from the very beginning, to, especially these days with the video games and the rest of the computer games and the things that you're just desensitized to human life.
Sure.
And then you're sent into this war situation, and it's actually, and your training for that seems to be, Sheikh says, it seems to her that it's like, it's basically akin to training people to be sociopaths in any situation that they confront.
Yeah, I can definitely see where she's coming from. I mean, I remember myself as a small child watching the John Wayne movies. The Green Berets was one of my favorite movies. And then playing with the G.I. Joes. And then when video games came out, playing all the war video games and the Contra from Nintendo all the way up to Call of Duty today. Yeah, it's everything in our society romanticizes U.S. military and war. And so these younger generations are seeing that. And here's another thing. Like, when have you not seen somebody in society saying that a soldier is a hero? You have stores donating money to soldiers saying that there are heroes and stuff like that. And Thank a Hero Day and Soldiers Angels and everything else like that. So you're essentially making soldiers out to be these heroes for doing these horrendous things in Iraq. And that's the problem I had when I came home on R&R. Is I had, coming through Dallas, I had 80-year-old women with pom-poms and kicking, doing high kicks and cheering me and little boys running up to me and asking me for my autograph like I was some kind of superstar. And preachers and pastors patting me on the back and saying I'm doing great things for God and country, the whole time in the back of my head saying, you don't know a damn thing of what you're talking about. And it's very difficult for soldiers to come home and take that hero hat off. You know, you wear a hero hat for so long, for you to turn around and say, I don't care what you think of me, but what you're saying is wrong. And I'm going to tell you exactly why. It's very difficult for soldiers to do it, and it took me a long time to do it as well.
Well, think about even something like the cadence that you had to train to when you were in boot camp.
Right.
You know, can you tell people a little bit about that?
Sure. The dehumanization of our enemies began early in boot camp. We used to run to cadences like, I went to the market where all the Haji shop, pulled out a machete, and I began to chop. I went to the playground where the Haji babies played, pulled out a hand grenade, and blew them all away. It's stuff like that on a daily basis. It's desensitizing soldiers and using racism, in a sense, to make these people subhuman. Or not important, not as important as humans or as Americans, especially. Americans in general already have this pompous idea that Americans deserve so much more than anybody else. You take a soldier, and we were trained to dehumanize civilians just as much as we were to dehumanize the enemies. Take, for example, Hurricane Katrina. Who did they send down there? The U.S. Army, the U.S. military. when they were having all the problems with the looting and the rioting and everything. Because the government knows that at some point they're going to have to send us soldiers against its own people. And so they dehumanize civilians in the very beginning to desensitize them to going and fighting their own kind.
You know, it's interesting because when you say that, this desensitization towards the humanity of the enemy and then towards of people in general, mm-hmm. civilians, it's very heavy because it is this scene where you think about, like you talked about in one of the earlier interviews or earlier article you did, you talked about the response that you could hear, that people can hear in the video from the cats in the Apache helicopter, and they're talking about, oh, or something. They said, oh, damn, we just, you know, there was children involved. But then immediately that response of, well, they shouldn't have brought them out to the battlefield. Mm-hmm. And you talked about that in a certain way that said the excuse is there's just self-justification for what they were doing.
Well, that's not actually self-justification in that sense. What that is that's a way of pushing your feelings down. That's a way of saying, okay, yeah, what I'm doing is wrong and I'm starting to feel bad, so I need my buddy next to me to pick me up. And it's a way to push those feelings down. Your self-justifications are, I'm doing this for my country. I'm doing this for God. I'm doing this to keep Americans free. Those are your self-justifications. And when those run out, you start to have issues with the soldier suicide. But it's kind of a gallows humor that we use it's a coping mechanism in Iraq. And that's what that is when we start to use callous talk and stuff like that, it'd be no different than how nurses and doctors may talk to each other when they're not around other people. And soldiers do that the same way. It's a coping mechanism. They use humor to push everything down. And the coping mechanism is, well, they shouldn't have brought their children to a battle. Because if you notice in the video, he started to feel bad immediately. And his buddy had to say, well, it's their fault for bringing the kids to a battle, when they both know we brought the battle to those kids.
Exactly. Quick reminder, we're talking with Ethan McCord today. And Ethan is a soldier who can be seen in the original WikiLeaks video that was released. And it's now known as the collateral murder video. And Ethan is the soldier carrying the children to safety, basically, to rescue, to help, basically, is what it is. Now, Ethan, one of those things, I think it's really important because when you're talking about this around this question of when people react that way, when they push their feelings down, in terms of the training, you have to be trained to do that because otherwise you couldn't go on in what you say is a very common occurrence, the savagery that's used against the Iraqi people. You, for instance, talked about having never seen before that time a 30-millimeter cannon used on humans.
Right.
And that's what was used in that?
Right. And you have to understand a 30-millimeter round is used for anti-armor. And they're depleted uranium rounds. When they hit, they explode. And you can just imagine what a round that's about as long as a ruler could do to somebody when it hits. I had never before seen humans with their insides on the outsides, and it was an extreme shock to the system. I mean, I think in a sense, I was trying to block it out and pretend that it wasn't real. The way that I can, it didn't look real to me. It looked like something I would have seen out of a horrible B horror movie. You know, like, oh, this can't be real. It's so fake. But, oh, man, it was real. It was very real. And unfortunately, I still see that today, you know, when I close my eyes. And the problem that we're having is, you know, with the training and the coping mechanisms that the Army's training soldiers to try to deal with these things, the soldier suicide rate has far exceeded the lost in combat numbers. So, and do you think soldiers are killing themselves because they're doing good things for God and country over in Iraq? Or do you think that there's something seriously wrong with what's going on over there?
Let me ask you this. You know, one of the things I told you before, I worked on the film Sir, No Sir, which told the story of GI resistance during the Vietnam War. Mm-hmm. Now, one of the things that happened there is that people did, I mean, the savagery in Vietnam was, you know, probably equal given to what what the situation was then in terms of what was available to soldiers to do. But I mean, even things where people cut off ears routinely and had necklaces, or they did the rape and the pillage, or the setting the whole villages on fire just for the hell of it.
Right.
You know, there was this terrible, terrible savagery that was unleashed against the Vietnamese people. And many, many soldiers came to the understanding of, as you've sort of indicated that you started to become aware of, that it's not just, it's a question, not that the soldiers are bad apples, but that the system, the soldiers are acting as part of a system, and that system's in command. In Vietnam, there was a lot of GI resistance that developed in response to the savagery that people were doing, and also in response to beginning to understand that the war, the character of the war was just wrong. You know, what's going on in Iraq in relation to that?
Well, I think it's a whole different thing because times are different now, and you know, soldiers just don't have the outlet. They don't have the support systems. I know that when I was in, I had never heard of "World Can't Wait," "We Are Not Your Soldiers," "Courage to Resist," anything like that. That's willing to step out there and say, "Hey, we're here to support you. Resist, and we can support you, and we can help you." And you know, the Army does a very good job of hiding that stuff from their soldiers. And you know, you're also, you know, if something was to happen to where you wanted to resist what was going on, soldiers would beat you up. And it's very difficult to buck the system when the system in whole is against you to begin with. You don't talk about these things with other soldiers because other soldiers are like, no, I'm good. Yeah, I'm good. You know, the savage. And here's the thing, the whole system, and like I said, these aren't a few bad apples strained from the system. This is the system in place, just like the Afghanistan kill team. You know, I didn't understand why everybody was so upset about that, because these are occurrences that happen all the time. Everybody takes photos like hunting trophies of killed Iraqis or Afghanis. Everybody does something as a war trophy. And it, throughout the Army, it's seen as common practice. And there's nothing wrong with it. The only thing that's wrong with it is when you get caught. And then generals and everybody else and colonels are like, oh, I had no idea he had those pictures, when they were sharing them themselves. So it's you know, we got to stop this whole let's blame the little guy and get these E4s and E3s and E5s and go after the people who are setting these standards to begin with. These are standards in place by leaders, not by privates. Privates don't run the Army. It's the leaders that run the Army. And we're still steadily trying to charge these privates with crimes when it's the leaders who are initiating them.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. Even in terms of your battalion commander, I read something about you had a very, very special battalion commander.
Yeah, yeah.
Can you tell people about that?
Yeah, my battalion commander was Pat Tillman's XO. In Afghanistan, he's the one who was on ESPN radio and said that Pat Tillman's family couldn't get over his death because they were atheists and something about Pat Tillman being worm dirt and he's a very controversial man. He said a lot of controversial things in my unit, and he's kind of like one of the, we used to call him the Lost Cause, Colonel Kozlerich, the Lost Cause, The thing is the Army loves guys like him. They don't want to put him in front of a microphone. He's kind of like the bastard son of the Army who, you know, we don't want him to go to formal dinner with us. But when, you know, the shit hits the fan, we're going to send him out into the dirt, you know. And
put a 30-millimeter cannon in his hands and he's fine.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah.
A quick reminder, this is the Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Ethan McCord, a former U.S. Army specialist who can be seen in the original video released by WikiLeaks that's now known as the collateral murder video. Ethan is the soldier carrying the children to safety, or actually the medical care, since there actually was no safety in that scene. Well, here's a question. You know, after this incident happened, you were in Iraq for how much longer?
8 more months.
What did you do during that time?
Well, during that time, I did my job. I pulled security. I refused to fire my weapon at people who were unarmed. If they were armed, I would fire my weapon at them, because honestly, I wanted to go home to my kids. And I was very angry being there. I was angry with the civilians back home. I was angry with my soldiers, but I think more so, I was angry with myself that I put myself in this predicament. That I bought this line that going over there, I was going to be providing these freedom and democracies. And, you know, I pretty much kind of did as much as I could to escape the reality of where I was and what I was. And through movies and music and phone calls home and whatnot. So, I just continued to do my job and to protect the guys to my left and right and to ensure that I went home. You know, I wasn't fighting in Iraq for your freedom. Like they say, people coming up to me afterwards saying, thanks for protecting me. You were the last guy on my mind.
You know, one thing that I did read, you said that something like that 360-degree rotational fire, that you said it wasn't uncommon for troops just like yourself to say, okay, we don't want to do this.
Right.
And then act otherwise. Can you talk about that?
Yeah. A couple soldiers and I had a discussion to where we were like, well, we don't want to kill innocent people. I'm not going to do it. But the NCOs in our battalion would make our lives hell if we didn't fire our weapons. There were plenty of times where soldiers would get hit, beat up, or as they called it, wall-to-wall counseling, take them into a room and beat the hell out of them because they wouldn't fire their weapons. So me and other soldiers decided, okay, well, we have to fire our weapons. What are we going to do? So we decided we're going to fire them into tops of buildings, or we're going to fire them into empty fields to give the illusion that we were doing what we were told, but without putting our own morals at stake by shooting innocent people, we would go ahead and fire into empty buildings and whatnot to give the illusion that we were following orders.
Was that something that was very common?
There was just a few of us who were willing to do that. Other soldiers, and I found it very interesting that other soldiers, especially the really young soldiers, were so quick to get the approval of their NCO, kind of like a father figure type of thing, that they were willing to kill people for them. And to get their approval of the NCOs who have been deployed 4 or 5 times, who hated the Iraqis and wanted to kill as many as possible because they may have lost a friend in the last deployment. So I was really shocked that a lot of them were willing to just openly kill people like that.
You know, one thing that I keep thinking about is when you came home and you began to speak out, how did that develop? You know, one of the things I realized as when we were working on Sir, No Sir, I realized that one of the things we discovered was that a lot of the GIs that ended up resisting and ended up speaking out against the horrors of the war were people who initially joined the military on a very idealistic basis, mm-hmm. You know, and then they ended up speaking out against the crimes that they had committed while taking part in the war. What was your path?
Well, I joined right after September 11th. I was raised conservative. Believed in America 100%. You know, we're not the bad guys, we're the good guys. You know, we're the ones out there spreading freedom and democracy to the oppressed. And I fully believed it. And it's something I've been raised my entire life to believe. So September 11th happened, and I felt that I could no longer enjoy the freedoms of my country without placing myself on the line, without putting myself out there to protect our freedoms and to protect the United States of America, who was so viciously attacked on September 11th. So I joined. I actually joined the Navy. I did 4 years in the Navy. Didn't feel I was doing enough. Felt I needed to be the one kicking down doors and attacking and killing the Muslims who attacked our country. So switched over to the Army Infantry and because I wanted to deploy to Iraq. And boy, I got my wish. I deployed to Iraq. And then I witnessed exactly what was going on and what was being done in our names over there, and realized that this is disgusting. And if this is what freedom and democracy look like, then I wanted absolutely no part of it.
Quick reminder, we're talking with Ethan McCord, who is a former specialist in the U.S. Army and who can be seen in the original WikiLeaks video that was released entitled Collateral Murder. Now, Ethan, tell me this, in terms of the resistance and your strength to resist, as well as the, you know, frankly, calling on other soldiers there, there's probably a hell of a lot more soldiers than anyone realizes who felt the same as you in terms of the questioning, in terms of the disgust at learning the truth. There's also a hell of a lot of soldiers who are upholding towing the line, basically.
Right.
You know, one of the things during the Vietnam War that was the whole society back home was in upheaval, and there was a massive anti-war movement that actually gave a lot of strength, I think, to the GI resistors, but also the GI resistors gave a lot of strength to the movement. What difference would it make if there had been, or if there was, a huge mass movement against the war today?
I think it would make a huge difference. Unfortunately, though, from what I've seen, being a former conservative and living, you know, a conservative life, is once I started coming over to the, I guess you could say, the left or the liberal or the anti-war movement, the one thing I've noticed is nobody can get their crap together. Everybody's fighting. I went to the peace conference and was speaking at the peace conference, and there was a fight that broke out in the peace conference. And I'm like, what is wrong with you? You know, and I've noticed people cannot put their petty differences to the side for 2 seconds and join up together and say, okay, what is the one thing that we want to accomplish right now? Well, we want to bring our troops and our war money home. Okay, let's get together. Forget all this other petty stuff that we are on the side. We can work on that later. Let's all work together to bring the troops and our war money home. When you do that and you can actually come together, there's empowerment in that. And once you accomplish that goal, then you can move on to, okay, well, what's our next step? You know, and I can tell you right now, from being conservative for most all of my life, is we were counting on the fact that the hippies, as we called them, couldn't get their stuff together.
You mean you were still fighting the hippies even generations after the hippies were gone, brother? Whoa!
You know, being from the military, anybody who didn't agree with the military was called a hippie.
Tells you actually, what's interesting is it shows you how much power and impact that whole movement had
exactly.
In the '60s. You know,
everybody was scared of the hippies.
That's very interesting.
And to this day, people are scared of the hippies.
That's very interesting. Very, very interesting. Now you've spoken out.
Mm-hmm.
Any repercussions? Like, and have you heard from soldiers that you knew?
Sure. Yeah, I've actually had death threats and threats against my children from some of the soldiers that I served with, people that I used to call brothers. And it's just for the simple fact that these soldiers are still trying to self-justify what they did in Iraq, why they serve, you know. It's just like if you were to go up to somebody and say that your politics are wrong and I don't agree with you and start spitting your beliefs in someone's face, what's the first thing that's going to happen? They're going to get angry. And the problem is when soldiers get angry, they've been trained to make threats and to pick up a weapon and be violent. And so all I'm doing is I'm challenging their point of view and their self-justifications, and they're not happy with that. So yeah, I've gotten a lot of I don't want to say a lot. I've gotten a few nasty emails or phone calls, but for the most part, I've received much more support.
How about from the upper echelons of the government? Any impact from there?
No, that nobody's really talked to me. Nobody gives two hoots about me. You know, the mainstream media ignores me, and there's nothing really going on there. So
I can assure you that they give more than two hoots about you because
I know they're watching me. They're doing something. I know it.
Well, I think, you know, just the fact, look, there's this tremendous strength in what you're doing, which I think people don't realize these days a lot, you know, and it's because it's so scattered in terms of, look, the impact of Iraq Veterans Against the War,
mm-hmm.
you know, has had a big impact. You know, there was they tried to have the Winter Soldier hearings in a lot of ways. When they were aired, when they happened, there was a tremendous impact that had on the public that heard them, but there was a very concerted attempt not to get that out as broadly right. as possible. And as I was telling you earlier, my friend who worked on a film on the bit, you know, David Zeiger, who's directed the Sir No Sir film, was working on a film, was one of the co-directors of a film on the new Winter Soldier hearings.
Right.
And it was called Here Is Where We Take Our Stand. And, you know, he has shopped that around and shopped that around. And he gets the response from all these major media that, who's interested in this anymore? We have Barack Obama in office. The war doesn't exist anymore, you know?
Right. It's you know, I will tell you that on YouTube, the Winter Soldier testimonies from the Iraq Veterans Against the War, they're still very powerful and still pulling a lot of people in there, and they're still being passed around. You know, and I think our battlefield is the internet. Obviously, mainstream media is not going to pay attention to us, So our battlefield is the internet, and as long as we can keep passing information that way, then we're in good terms. We'll get the word out.
Quick reminder, we're talking with Ethan McCord today, and Ethan is a soldier who can be seen in the original WikiLeaks video that was released, and it's now known as the collateral murder video, and Ethan is the soldier carrying the children to safety, basically, to rescue, to help, basically, is what it is. Let's talk about this. One of the things you did since you came back was you wrote and issued a letter of reconciliation to the Iraqi people. Right. Tell us about that.
Me and Josh Stieber, who when we got back and the video was released, we wrote a letter of reconciliation and responsibility to the people of Iraq. Originally, it was going to be just for the families of the victims that day, but then we decided that it needs to be for the entire country of Iraq. And the reason being is we're acknowledging that our parts in the destruction of their way of life and their country. And we're stating that, you know, granted, the government's ignoring you and your pleas for they're also ignoring many veterans who are coming home troubled and wounded by what they've seen and done in your country. And we're also letting the people of Iraq know that there are people here in the U.S. who care about what happens to them. They have it set in their head in Iraq that nobody cares about them. And just like Robert Gates, when this video was released, getting up and stating that America was not going to lose its reputation over this video. And me and Josh stood up and said, well, no, America's reputation pales in importance to our common humanity with these people. And for far too long, we've allowed our representatives and our nation's leaders to represent us when they don't. Their values and their morals do not represent us. And we want more people to stand up and say that.
Let's talk about the importance. This will be the final question. Let's talk about the importance of speaking out. And in particular, you once said that you don't think that the big question in Iraq is whether the Iraqis, whether it was in that video or anywhere else, were standing up and taking up arms against the U.S. forces. But the big question was, what's the U.S. doing there? And you also said that you realized at a certain point that you had far more in common with the Iraqi people than you did with the people who sent you to war.
Right, yeah. You know, it's kind of a funny thing because when you go to a country and you expect to quote unquote free them, and you get to, you know, yeah, I'm going to Iraq, I'm going to provide freedom and democracy, and you get there, and in talking with the people of Iraq, you realize that in return, the people of Iraq are the ones who are freeing me. I'm no longer from seeing what happened in Iraq and living it, I was no longer a blind slave to my government saying, I will do as you please, when you please, aye, aye, sir. I turned around and I actually began to think for myself and to say, no, this is wrong. You know, I don't care what you say, and I'm going to resist this. So in a sense, yeah, the people of Iraq freed me, not the other way around. And it's been a very big turn of events for me. I mean, as I said, I grew up my entire life believing one thing, and in a heartbeat, I had to redefine who I am, what I think, and what I believe. And, what are we doing in Iraq? People ask me that all the time. What are we doing in Iraq? Well, you tell me, because I have no idea, and I spent many, many months there.
Again, though, on the question of the importance of yourself speaking out and other troops that have come home speaking out about what happened there, what do you think the importance of that is?
Well, the importance is, and I don't know, you know, how far this will go, but who would you rather listen to? Would you rather listen to a politician, an old, rich, white politician sitting up on Capitol Hill saying, we're in Iraq for good reasons and we're going to be there and this is why and you should listen to me? Or would you rather listen to the veterans who are coming home saying, look, we've been there. We lived it. This is wrong. There is nothing good happening in Iraq. Who would you rather listen to? I would hope you would rather listen to the person who lived it. And that's what I'm trying to put out there. That's what all of the other veterans who've been over there are trying to put out there is, look, we lived it. What these people are telling you are wrong. We lived it, and we're here to tell you that there is nothing good happening there. We're doing nothing but horrible things. And in fact, we're making more enemies for the United States.
Ethan McCord, thank you very much for coming in today, and thank you for what you've done, man.
Thank you for having me.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate. We've just been listening to a conversation I had with Ethan McCord, and Ethan is the soldier seen in the original WikiLeaks video, Collateral Murder. Ethan's the soldier who was attempting to get some of the wounded children in that video to, not to safety because there was no safety, but to medical care, something that went straight up against everything he had been taught and conditioned to do in these situations. We're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we'll be joined by Keith Knight, cartoonist, all right? So don't miss that. Stay tuned. All right, welcome back. This is The Michael Slate Show, and that was Woody Woodpecker, okay? And that's from Chuck Brown, DC Go-Go Chuck Brown. Really, really great song, and I picked that because my next guest has put me in that kind of a mood, but it also was one of the biggest shapers of my kind of worldview from the time I was a kid. Woody Woodpecker just, that was the dude I ran with, man. Woody Woodpecker was there all the time. And I'm really pleased to welcome to the show right now Keith Knight. And Keith is part of Keith is a very talented young African-American artist whose work is, and he does a lot of, he's a cartoonist. He does editorial cartoons. He does, you know, serial cartoons. His work appears in a number of newspapers around the country. And his work is always infused with urgency, edge, humor, satire, politics, and race. Keith, welcome to the show.
It's an honor to be here, Michael.
And I have to tell you one of the most impressive things. See, this is, you're learning where I'm coming from. Woody Woodpecker and Mad Magazine. Your work has been in Mad Magazine.
Yeah. I just found out I'm going to be part of Mad Men, a panel of mad cartoonists down at San Diego this year in July. So I'm going to be on a panel with Sergio and a few of the other greats. So pretty excited about that.
What a life, man. Some people get all the breaks. Let's talk about this, your newest book, Too Small to Fail, a Think anthology. First, Think. I mean, tell people what this is. Just give them a sense of what this book is.
Well, Think is my socio-political single-panel comic strip. Probably about a little over 10 years ago, I was asked by Africana.com, which no longer exists. It's a black culture website, asked me to do a comic strip. They really liked the K Chronicles, my autobiographical strip. So they invited me in and they said, we'd love for you to do another strip for us. And I wanted to do something completely the opposite of the K Chronicles. The K Chronicles is autobiographical. It's about my life. It's me, multi-panel. What I want to do is something completely the opposite. So I wanted to do a single panel. I wanted to take it from the news. I didn't want it to be about me. And so I remember showing up to the meeting, and I drew on a bar napkin a comic strip that had the sign Denny's, and then under Denny's it said serving black people since 1997 or something like that. And I put, if signs told the truth. And I gave that to them. I said, this is what I want to do. And they all looked at it and they said, you got the job. And, so it just went from there. And you know, what was nice about it was by that time I had understood the importance of having the rights to the strip and what was, you know, all the different rights issues. So I gave them the rights to run it for the first week in color, exclusively for them. But after that, for me to be able to send it out there and syndicate it myself. And it really was beneficial for me to do that because when Africana shut down, I had all these other outlets for the strip already set in place. So it made it worth it for me. So
let me ask you this. You said once that when people tried to sort of shoehorn you into a narrow wedge of political cartoonists, you said, I don't really want to be considered a political cartoonist. But with Think and the single panel cartoons you do, they're editorial cartoons, and by their very nature, they have a political content a lot of times in the broadest sense.
Yeah, even my dailies and my autobiographical weeklies have some sort of political bent to it a lot of times. But I just don't want it, it's not like a traditional Think is not like a traditional political cartoon. I will do not just stuff about politicians, about traditional political cartoon leanings. I'll do lifestyle stuff. I'll do music stuff. I just did, well, I guess I have to say that's sort of a little bit of political too, but you know, Gil Scott Heron's passing.
Very beautiful piece, by the way. I saw that. I was really impressed with it.
Thank you. But, you know, I've done when someone who's a pretty meaningful part of my life passes, I'll do a strip about it, and it's not necessarily political. One of my favorite pieces in here is one I did when Michael Jackson died.
And, I love that. That is so gripping, man. Go ahead.
Oh, yeah. Cool. Yeah, yeah. And so it's those type of things that I think make Think more than just a political strip.
Let me remind listeners that you're tuned into the Michael Slate Show, and I'm talking right now to Keith Knight, cartoonist, about his new book, Too Small to Fail, a Think Anthology. Really a great book. People should definitely check this out. Well, let's talk about this. When you do a single panel, you have to compress. I mean, I'd like to talk to you a little bit about the process, because you have to compress so much into one panel. And I read somewhere where you said, look, part of the problem you face is that you come up with ideas, and if you look at like everything that's going on in the world, it's all coming at you at once. And then sometimes you're worried that, well, if I don't really concentrate on this, I'll just have my character shouting and screaming and calling names. How do you avoid that? How do you get to that point where you actually capture the essence, the comedic essence and the ironic essence of what you're trying, of the subject matter?
Well, it's very easy to get angry and it's very easy to react out of anger. But we all know that that's like usually the worst way to react. So what I like to do is take an issue in and just kind of stew over it for a while and doodle and kind of work with it and see if there's another angle to look at it at, you know, because there is another angle to look at it at. We tend to look at something one way a lot of times. But, you know, if you're able to take the time out and look at it from a few different angles, you may be able to come up with something that someone has not come up with before. And it's really tough now because you get people who are turning stuff over like Jon Stewart of The Daily Show. He's got a bunch of writers working on that, all that type of stuff. So you kind of want to make sure you're not repeating, you know, the same jokes over and over again. So I'll have a lot of discussions with people at the cafe I draw at. That's one of the things I really like to do. I've got certain people that I love having conversations with. My political guy. I got my right wing guy. I got just my total spaced out person that I talk to, and they all give me these great ideas, and they don't know they're giving me great ideas. It's usually those are the best ideas. When people run up to me and go, oh, I have this great idea for a comic strip, it's usually not a great idea.
Okay, I'll take that off the list.
there was one. Someone gave me a great idea for a comic strip, and I was like, wow, I'm going to do that. But another guy gave me the story about, you know, I did one about the time when, did you hear about the canvasser during Barack Obama's campaign? And it was in Western Pennsylvania. And it was a white canvasser. And she was asking somebody, you know, who are you going to vote for? And they said, we're going to vote for the N-word. That's how they said it. That's not how they said
it. Right,
but,
I got it.
But I just thought, wow, like, this is like, what a weird story. Like, this is a completely insane story that someone would, you know, call him this, but vote for him to be the most powerful person like in the world. And so I did this strip about it, and I just drew that verbatim, the story, after looking around on the web and confirming it. And like just all hell broke loose because of it, because of what I... And the thing is, I never wrote the word. I didn't say N-word, but I wrote... It was a person standing in a house, and when they said it, it said N-I-G-G, and then, like, the rest of the word went into the house. But it didn't matter. Like, people went nuts over it. And there was even a school in Western Pennsylvania where some of the black students were protesting. Oh, no, that's something different. That's another controversy. That was another controversy. I'm sorry. But, no, this was in Arizona where they were protesting for that one. But the ones in Western Pennsylvania were wearing nooses around their neck because I had done a strip about all the people protesting Obama, just like, you know, you could tell that it has a lot to do with his race. And I said, there's no way he could possibly say that because everyone will say you're just pulling the race card. So what I did was I drew a picture of somebody with a noose around their neck, a black man with a noose around their neck, and all these white people about to lynch him. And he's saying, you're doing this because I'm black, aren't you? And then one of the white people's throwing their hands up going, see, there you go, pulling the race card again. And it didn't go over very well. One campus, though. Everywhere else, it was fine.
A quick reminder, you're tuned into The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Keith Knight, cartoonist, editorial cartoonist, and we're talking about his latest book, Too Small to Fail. Well, let me ask you this. One subject that you seem to have been particularly struck by, and I thought you did some very powerful work, and it was more, it wasn't so much on that, although there were a couple, I think, that were in the single panel cartoon form, but there was also, you did it in the strip comic, it was Katrina.
Oh, yeah.
You seem to be very deeply impacted by that, and I thought the work you did on that was remarkable, and especially there was one where you told the story of Katrina, and it paralleled very closely the story of slavery. I was just blown away by that piece, man.
Oh, cool. Thank you. I started going to New Orleans in the late 90s. A friend of mine, Matt Schwartzman, and I worked on a book called The Beginner's Guide to Community-Based Art. He moved to New Orleans. So basically, we were interviewing all these artists that use their work for social change. And he would interview them. I would take the interviews, make comic book stories out of them. And we were doing it in different regions. We were picking different artists around the country, but one of the group of artists we picked were in New Orleans. But a lot of the work I was doing, I was drawing a lot of the stuff in New Orleans. And I just got to know, and once you go to New Orleans and get to know the city, you just fall in love with it completely. And so just after being there a few times and just having, you know, what happened to it happened, just amazed. It was so, you know, just it's really hard to explain. But I just saw so many parallels in what I had read about slavery. You know, I can't say I've experienced it. You know, if you looked at my syndicate deal, you might might argue with that. But yeah, it really did profoundly affect me, and I'm glad that you acknowledge that strip because it's one of my favorites.
Well, there's also, and we won't have that much time. We won't have any time to talk about this one. But I wanted to raise another subject that you seem to be particularly moved by, which is police brutality. And people should definitely check out your work on that. And I wanted to know, back on this question that you were talking about, people protesting you, but what about censorship and what about the kind and attacks around the work that you do? You know, I was thinking about, for instance, the cover of this Too Small to Fail has a very good ironic piece on Obama's Yes We Can, and people will see it. And you actually, you know, you go in a lot of it, you're talking about, you're showing what actually has happened since what people thought would change reality. And Dr. Cornel West is currently under a tremendous amount of attack for publicly telling the truth about Obama and criticizing him and questioning what's going on. And they're really trying to marginalize him, shut him up, all this stuff. I mean, just outrageous assaults. Do you experience any kind of censorship with your work for telling the truth?
I would say that, you know, a lot of times my stuff, when it starts, riles something on a campus or in the newspaper somewhere, they just immediately get rid of it, which drives me up a wall because I think even when people complain about my strip, I think it starts a dialogue that I think is incredibly important. I think if my strip was just completely mediocre, which a lot of strips are, and people just don't write or do anything about it, is detrimental, because what you want to do as a newspaper, as a website, as something, is you want to provoke, you want to get people to actively participate. So I think my strips do that. But I found myself censored a lot in the Bay Area, of all places, because they were saying, like, I was offending different types of people and all this stuff.
Well, I want to hear you sometime tell the story about your attempt to rent black people when gentrification was first moving in, and to give people a chance to have instant diversity in their parties. We can't talk about it now because we got to get out, but it was a really great piece. I really liked it. And the book is Too Small to Fail, a Think Anthology. Make sure you pick it up.
I promise to say hello to my son, Jasper, and my wife, Kirsten. Hi.
Okay, and hi from me too. All right, I'm Michael Slate, and you've been listening to The Michael Slate Show. I want to thank my engineer for today, Teddy Robinson, my production assistant, Henry Carson, and all of you for tuning in. And I'd also like to thank my guests for today, Ethan McCord and Keith Knight. If you want to check out Keith Knight's work, go to kchronicles.com. That's kchronicles.com. You can check out all of his work, see all of his various forms of work. And if you want to get in touch with Ethan McCord, you know, I'd really suggest contacting World Can't Wait, their project We Are Not Your Soldiers, or contacting Military Families Speak Out, and I'm sure either one of them will be happy to help you set up bringing Ethan to your school or to your city or whatever to hear him speak. A really, as you can tell, a really compelling, really important speaker with something very important to say. All right, before we go out now, I'd like to read a couple of quotes from Bob Avakian's new book, Basics. You know, on the one hand, we've been talking a lot about truth today with both Keith and Ethan, and I think it's really important that we think about truth, and I think it's important that we really always strive to tell the truth. One thing we got to remember is that the truth will not set us free in and of itself, but we will not get free without the truth. And then one other quote that I think is also fits very much into the theme of today's program and a very, very important thing to go away with is this: American lives are not more important than other people's lives. Very simple, very true, very important. Those quotes are from Bob Avakian and his new book, Basics. You can't change the world without knowing the basics. And this book, Basics, is drawn from the talks and writings of Bob Avakian. All right, well, that brings our show to a close today, and I want to thank again all of you for tuning in, and keep on coming back to visit us. You know where to find us. As I say each and every week, we're right here on the corner of epistemology and morality, so check us out. If you want to write to me, you can, and please do write to me with all of your comments, ideas, suggestions, criticisms, whatever, just saying hello. Drop me a line at michaelslate@redfuture.com. Again, that's michaelslate@redfuture.com. All right, we're going to go out now with a song that I found particularly gripping in relation to Ethan today. And that song is from The Zombies, a really old song, a really great group. The song is Butcher's Tale, Western Front, 1914, a very powerful anti-war song. Talk to you again next week.
The Butcher, yes, that was my trade. King's shilling is now my fee. The butcher, I may as well have stayed for the slaughter that I see. And the preacher in his pulpit sermon, go and fight to what is right. But he don't have to hear these guns, and I bet he sleeps at night.